Before we get into material for today, I want to review just a bit of what we talked about last week. Last week, we began to take a close look at the creation story in Genesis 1 and 2, and we found that if we look carefully at the text, we get the impression not so much that God created everything out of nothing, like poof, there it is, there it appears. But if we read the text carefully, we get more of the sense that God was shaping and forming that which was cold and dark and chaotic and completely inhospitable into something that was beautiful and warm and inviting, a place where creatures could flourish and life on earth could flourish and thrive. And we mentioned last week how in creation, God gets his hands dirty. He gets his hands into the dirt and makes stuff. It's physical in creation. God makes stuff. In the incarnation, God becomes stuff. He becomes physical. In the resurrection, God restores stuff. He brings stuff back to life. He redeems the physical. And so we begin to think of this in terms of work, and we see that really no work should be thought of as menial, as degrading. Because I mean, Jesus was a carpenter. God dug ditches, right? You look at the Grand Canyon. It's a great big ditch. Because God is a creator, he loves to put his hands in the dirt and create. And so we begin to develop this strong creational theology that affects the way we think about work and the way we work. And one of the things it does is kind of dissolves this sacred-secular distinction that we are used to making, right? Mentioned last week that it's not my job as a pastor then to wrestle people away from their so-called secular jobs in order that they can help with, you know, the more spiritual kind of work. That's not my job. It's my job is to rather erase those categories and invite us to erase those categories so that Christ is shown as Lord of all of life and all of our lives, that Christ isn't just Lord on Sunday mornings and maybe Wednesday evenings, but Lord, Christ is Lord of all of life. In all areas. And we begin to see how this relates to work when we look at the nature of creation, where God, in the early chapters of Genesis, takes that place that is inhospitable, cold, and chaotic, and dark, and he makes room for his creatures. And then not only makes room for his creatures, but that helps those creatures flourish in that room that he's created. Neil Plantinga has said that creation is the ultimate act of hospitality. I love that picture. It's hospitality. That God doesn't need us. God doesn't need the created order. But he creates room and then helps us to flourish in that room. That's hospitality. And God gives that mandate to our first parents, to Adam and Eve in the garden, to continue that very work. People, as image bearers of God, were given this mandate to carry on this work of God in helping to cultivate and bring out the potential in creation in order to help make life flourish. We continue that work of hospitality. And that's what I want to look at a little bit more this morning and just focus a little bit more on that act of our work as cultivation. Our work as hospitality. What should our work really accomplish? What should it look like? And I want to notice again, go back again to those early chapters of Genesis for a little while. In Genesis, again in chapter 1, this time in verses 11 and 12, God talks about the trees and the vegetation. And God says, let the land produce vegetation, let it flourish and let it multiply after its own kind. Let it. And then in verses 20 and 21, we have the creation of the birds and the fish. And again, there's that sense of let the oceans teem with fish and let the sky teem with flying creatures. Let them multiply according to their kind. And then verse 24, let the land produce livestock and animals. Let them multiply. Again, let it happen. It's all very passive. And then the pattern is broken. In verse 28, we come to the creation of humans, and the pattern is broken. No longer is it passive. Let the earth do this. Let them do this. Let them multiply. But now God gives Adam and Eve a very specific mandate. It's a very active command. Be fruitful. Multiply. Rule. Fill. You do this. You be intentional about this. This isn't something that just happens automatically, just happens naturally, because what God is calling our first parents to do is far more intentional than just reproduce. The filling that God calls us to do takes intentionality and takes thought. It involves cultivating it. It involves civilizing. Something very distinct from what God was calling the plant and animal world to. God wanted more than just an increase in the number of humans. He wanted a human society. Notice where God puts our first parents to work. He puts them in where? The garden, right? The Garden of Eden. Now contrast what a garden is to, say, a national park, right? God didn't create park rangers whose sole job it is to make sure nothing gets touched and everything just goes naturally. That's what a park ranger does. That's not what God created. Nor does God call Adam and Eve to just plow over the garden, maybe pave over it. But what does a gardener do? The gardener doesn't just let it grow wild. The gardener doesn't just pave over it. The gardener very thoughtfully and intentionally rearranges the natural and the raw materials so that it becomes more beautiful, more fruitful, more helpful. That's what a gardener does. Some of you own gardens, some of you have work gardens, and it's hard work and it's thoughtful work. What's going to grow best here? What's going to grow best in this climate? How do we arrange these plants in such a way that they'll cooperate with the other plants and so on? It's arranging these things. That's what God calls Adam and Eve to do. To draw out the potential of the garden so that it can flourish and add to human flourishing. And that is part of the biblical mandate for work. That's what work is about. So again, take a look at these outfits that are hanging around us. Back in that corner, there is a chef outfit. It's that white shirt with the gray checkered pants and the white hat. That's a chef outfit. Think of what the chef does, taking the raw materials, the basic raw materials, like an egg. I think I was 13 years old. I watched the Rocky movie and I thought, I want to get big muscles, so I'm going to drink raw eggs. And I did. I ate one raw egg. And I got it down, but that was the last one I ever ate. Anybody go home and eat just spoonfuls of flour? Nasty. Christy was telling me last night that vanilla actually tastes just wretched. It smells great, but I've never tasted it. She says, you ought to try it sometimes. It's horrible. And yet somehow a chef can take those kinds of nasty ingredients, slimy fish, mushrooms. Mushrooms are fungus, right? You know that, fungus. And somehow a chef can take this nasty stuff, draw out its potential, and we're willing to pay big money to eat it. A good chef, I understand, can even make vegetables taste good. But it's gardening. It's cultivating. You see that dress in that back corner? That's my wife Christy's dress, actually. She got that when she started teaching, and a little vest with school stuff. She used to wear it, actually, quite a bit when she was teaching, especially with little kids, like little pictures and stuff like that. But teaching, taking an uninformed, naive human mind and organizing ideas under topics and subjects and teaching them until a young person, until it kind of takes hold and it's meaningful and it sticks. Or the scientist in the white lab coat. What does a scientist do? They're drawing out the potential. They're unfolding the properties of material and matter and energy until something is brought forth that's beyond what they had at the beginning. We have some musicians as part of the congregation. What does a musician do? I mean, you boil it down, a musician takes the raw material of just sound and puts rhythm and puts sound together with other sounds in ways that become beautiful and powerful and inspiring, drawing out that potential, and it becomes thrilling and meaningful. You're gardening, you're cultivating when you're working. You're rearranging these raw materials of God's creation in a way that it helps the world and its inhabitants flourish. You're doing the work of God. Tim Keller writes about an occasion when the president of Fuller Seminary, Richard Mao, spoke and addressed a bunch of bankers in New York. And he read through these opening chapters of Genesis and showed them and actually referred to God as an investment banker. He said, God's an investment banker. He leverages his resources to create a whole world of new life. In the same way, he says, you as an investment banker, if you see a human need that is not being met, and you have resources that can meet that need, and you invest those resources to that need, and it's met, and new jobs are created, and new products are created, and a better way of life is the result, what are you doing? It says you're cultivating, you're gardening, you're doing the work of God. After the address, a lot of the bankers went up to Richard Mao and says, you know, would you come and speak to my pastor? Because he thinks all we're about is trying to make money. Now, that may be the case in some people, but business, wearing a suit like that, is part of cultivating, gardening. That's the first thing God designed work to be about and work to be for. It's cultivating. And this is a really good reason why tomorrow morning you can wake up with an unmistakable passion for work. That you get to join in doing the work of God and cultivating His creation, bringing forth the potential. But secondly, God has designed work also to serve people, to serve the common good. If you have your Bibles open, I invite you to turn to the passage that we read this morning from Psalm 147. And that psalm is the circumstances of the psalm. As you read it, you get the sense that it's about the context of national tragedy, right? In verse 2, the Lord builds up Jerusalem. He returns. He gathers exiles of Israel. Perhaps, we don't know exactly what the context is, but you get the sense that maybe there was some kind of an economic collapse. Maybe there was a military invasion coupled with that, and the people of God had been scattered. But this psalm is basically all about, take heart. The God who created everything is still the God who is in charge. He is still your God. He still loves you. He'll bring you back. He cares for you. He is a God who will heal his people and restore them. It's a hopeful song. It's a hopeful song in the midst of despair and despondency. Take heart. Take heart. God is still in control. And then look down specifically at verses 13 and 14. It says that God strengthens the bars of your gate, and he blesses your people within you. He grants peace to your borders. What's the psalmist talking about here? Strengthening your gates, peace in your borders, strong gates. He's talking about political and economic strength and stability for the nation, right? And that's what he's referring to. How does that happen? Does God just kind of look down from heaven and wave his hand and say, now that nation is secure? How does it happen? Well, it happens partially through some very wise and competent military planning and execution. It happens through good diplomacy with one's neighbors. It happens through sound monetary policy. It happens through government policy and laws that promote economic health and robust trade with one's neighbors. I mean, that's how the bars get strengthened. It's passages like this that caused John Calvin to even regard government. Now, this might just blow your mind. Government is a sign of God's love for us. It's a means of grace, Calvin taught. Because government adjusts life in society toward righteousness and promotes a general peace and tranquility. Believe it or not, and this is a quote from Calvin, believe it or not, this is what John Calvin says. He went so far as to declare, quote, civil authority is a calling, not only holy and lawful before God, but it's the most sacred, by far the most honorable of all the callings in all of mortal men. I don't know what kind of drugs were around back then, but John Calvin, would you really? Yeah, really. Because whether you're just on a city council or whether you're the president of the United States himself, you are being used of God in doing this kind of stuff from Psalm 147. This kind of stuff comes through the policies that you're implementing. Take a look at the last part of the verse 14. He satisfies you with the finest wheat. How does that happen? How does God satisfy us with the finest wheat? Again, does God look down and wave his hand and suddenly there's bounty? God certainly could. He's done it before. You remember manna in the wilderness? You remember the baskets that Jesus, you know, distributed, the fish and the bread, and came back with 12 baskets overflowing with bread. I mean, God does that. He can do that. There's no reason he can't. But is that the way God normally works? No. How does God do this? How does God satisfy us with the finest wheat? What he's saying is he's talking about health and well-being and that God cares for us personally. God cares for his people personally. He even provides for our nutrition and food. And how does he do this? Martin Luther, he writes, God could easily give you grain and fruit without you plowing and planting, but he doesn't choose to do so. Or you think when you say the Lord's Prayer, give us today our daily bread, how does God answer that prayer? He answers that prayer through the person who sells and maintains the irrigation equipment, through the farmer who plants and harvests the grain, through the train engineer who actually transports this stuff way across the country. God answers that prayer through the truck driver who delivers it to the store, to the baker, to the actual retail outlet, through the stock clerk who puts the bread on the shelves, even the website programmer. All of these people working together, contributing to satisfy you with the finest wheat. That's how God is doing it. Again, we look around the room. You see over here, the mechanic. You know, we often, before we go on a trip, we'll say, pray for me. Pray for safety. I'm going so and such place. Well, how does God answer that prayer? Well, a big part of it is through the mechanic that did a competent job putting the brakes back on your car, so they function predictably and within certain parameters. Or you look over here, the nurse's scrubs. And we often would pray for healing. Somebody's sick, somebody's struggling. God, bring healing. How does God bring healing? God certainly can and certainly does bring healing. Just, it's a miracle. But God often works through somebody wearing something like that. Just taking blood pressure, distributing medication, discerning and drawing blood and testing that blood and discerning variations that could be indications of some problems. All this to say, God's incredible work of providence, God caring for His people, happens simply, often, through simply people just doing their job, serving one another. That's another great reason to get up tomorrow morning and get ready to go to work with enthusiasm, with passion. You actually get to be used of God in carrying out His act of providence in the world and caring for His people. Now, something I don't know if I've ever really articulated this very clearly, but to me, a sermon, if a sermon could be preached in a Muslim mosque or a Jewish synagogue, that's not a Christian sermon. And it's good advice, maybe good stuff to say, but unless it's rooted in the gospel, unless it's rooted in the good news of Jesus Christ, I don't think it's a sermon. So what does this have to do with the gospel? Or rather, what does the gospel have to do with this, what we've been talking about? Religion says, if I want, and we mentioned this before, if I want God's attention, if I want God's blessing, if I want Him to pay attention to me, there's certain things I got to do, and I've got to jump through these religious hoops, and I got these rites and ceremonies and rituals that I got to get right so that God will pay attention and like me. If that's true, then people involved in church ministry or parachurch ministry are always going to be fundamentally in far better shape spiritually than everybody else, right? Because that's what we do all the time. But if the gospel of Jesus Christ is that, no, you don't get God's attention by doing these rituals. That's not how to get God's merit and His blessing. But if we're rescued by the grace of God, if jumping through religious hoops does absolutely nothing to earn favor with God, then that totally causes us to rethink the nature of work, doesn't it? I mean, I shared this with the worship team a couple of weeks ago, that this thought, this question, just totally revolutionized my mind in the nature of work and how to understand work. I think it was from Tim Keller. I don't remember. Usually if it's something that I can't remember the source, it goes back to Tim Keller, I have to admit. He asked the question. Somebody did. I think it was Keller. Asked the question. You have a Christian pilot of a commercial airplane. And this pilot is flying at 40,000 feet and has 200 passengers. What is the highest responsibility as a Christian for that pilot?
Not to land abruptly.
It's, yeah, exactly. It's to land safely. Land those 200 souls safely. And when I begin to think about that, that began to shift my way of thinking just pretty radically. That God does not, in order for that pilot to be a faithful Christian, that pilot does not have to get on the intercom and share the gospel. That pilot does not have to stand at the door as people walk out and give gospel tracts. That pilot has got to land that plane safely. And he is just as much, if he is in Christ, a child of God, as Billy Graham. Here's another implication of the gospel of grace. A lot of people, when they think about their career, a lot of people, when they think about what they're going to commit their lives to do, their job, they ask, what career is going to land the biggest paycheck, and what career is going to give me the most status, prestige? How can I make the most money, and how can I make a name for myself? And then how many people aren't stuck in a job they can't stand, but they're forced to stay there because that's where they make the most money, and that's where they prove to others that they're okay because they're successful. And so they're forced to stay in that kind of a job. But the gospel of Jesus Christ frees us from this relentless pursuit of money and a relentless pursuit of a name through our job. Right? Jesus frees us from that because we're already secure for all eternity. Remember Ephesians 1. Paul prays that we would know the hope to which he's called us, the riches of his glorious inheritance in the saints. That's what we have, the inheritance of God himself as God's children. All right, we're as secure as we can be if we are in Christ. And we have a name. We are children of God. And so we're free now to work and just work to love God through our work and love and serve our neighbor through our work with joyful abandon. Competent work is a form of love. It's a form of service to our neighbor. And we're not imprisoned by this need to get more and more and to secure for ourselves a name. That's what the gospel does for us. So some of you, as you think about your career options, some of you are studying, you're in school yet, you're still thinking about what's to come. The question is no longer what's going to make me the most money, what's going to give me the most status. The gospel frees us to ask, how, with my existing abilities and opportunities, how can I be of greatest service to others?